Mini-episode 992 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late-night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to mini episode number 992. This is FDH managing partner Rick Morris here with a rite of spring in the FDH Lounge, as has been the case the last 3 years. We're here to talk NBA Finals, specifically Cavs Warriors, with fellow FDH Lounge dignitary Ben Chu, one of our big hoops heads in the FDH Lounge. And again, we've been breaking down basketball longer than 2015 together in the lounge, but for the last 4 years, it's been Cavs, Warriors. Perhaps the next 4 years, the way things are going too, Ben Chu, who knows? This summer we'll have a lot to say about that, but for right now, we're right back where we started at the end of May each of the last 3 years.
It's ironic, isn't it? We keep getting back on the treadmill again. same exact matchup 4 years in a row.
It is amazing. I mean, the NBA had never had it 3 years in a row before last year. Now it's gone to 4 years. 3 years in a number of different sports has been just about non-existent. But again, this is a thing pretty much completely unprecedented in sports history for it to go the way that it has. It's a matchup that I have to say again, you and I are recording this in the immediate aftermath of Game 7 of the Western Conference Finals. I was daring to be optimistic, looking ahead during the game to a possible Cavs-Houston matchup in the finals. I was prepared to say Cavs in six if it was going to be Houston without Chris Paul. But again, not so fortunate from a Cavs perspective. Golden State, yet again, man, you talk about a charmed life. Houston without Chris Paul last year. You got the situation there in San Antonio where Zaza Pachulia accidentally on purpose ends up taking out the best player. 2015, no Kyrie, no Love to play against. The Golden State Warriors and their damn voodoo doll does it again, Ben Chu.
Well, like I said to it in this narrative, the Houston Rockets are not without blame either. They had, whenever you have a series lead like that, and you have two games to win, and especially game seven at home, you have arguably the reigning, but the possible MVP in James Harden. You have to learn how to close the door. And very similar to game seven of the Boston series, a third quarter in a game seven doomed Houston pretty much. That's all you can really say, because you cannot, for the life of me, live in the three-point territory of the NBA and shoot below 28%. You can't. You're not going to win games shooting less than 28%.
Right.
If that is your thing.
Right. Tired legs on both sides, just like tired legs on both sides of Game 7 in the Eastern Conference Finals. I, as a lifelong Cavs fan and optimist, could say 24 hours for the Cavs to recover that Golden State won't have. Then again, they'll be at home. I think the Warriors would probably make that trade-off. We'll talk about the finals here in a little bit. I understand that, at least in terms of the title of this segment, that's our focus. But again, because there is so much about this finals matchup that seems obvious, at least on the surface, to dig a little bit deeper and to do what we're going to do, quite frankly, isn't going to take much time because there's not too much to say other than the obvious narrative. Instead, we're going to start out here by looking back at the first couple of rounds of the playoffs. And really something I commented on to you before, Ben, that almost an Arab Spring kind of narrative here this spring, as far as, you know, the toppling of some of the dictatorships of years past. Not that Oklahoma City is necessarily a monolith, because they've only made it to one finals during their run, but seeing them go down at the hands of young Utah and seeing Boston make the run that they did behind Jason Tatum, Philly through at least the first run after that huge winning streak at the end of the regular season. It's a thing where I'm struggling to remember this. You and I are both sort of hoops historians here. A year where you've seen so much of the future, you're looking at it and you're saying, wow, is the future now? In the end, it wasn't the case. It's Cavs and Golden State just like we thought it was going to be. But I can't remember a playoff year where so many of these upstarts looked like they were just going to burst through the barricades, as so many of them looked like they were going to do about a month or so ago.
Right, and especially a lot of people were talking during that draft that it was one of the deeper drafts of all time, and it's becoming very apparent that it was. Donovan Mitchell is clearly the breakout star for the playoffs as a rookie, and, you know, Simmons and Embiid and Philly had a magnificent run up until their matchup with Boston. Got a lot of good young talent in the league, and especially with this year's draft coming up, you're going to get even better young talent coming in. So it's going to be interesting to see how the trajectory of teams like Utah and Boston and Philly are going to be in the next couple of weeks to months to determine how they're going to improve on their hot starts in the playoffs.
Absolutely, because it was a wild, wild playoff run on both sides here thus far to this point, and the opposite of a year ago when there was pretty much no drama en route to the seemingly inevitable Cleveland Golden State final. This year, at various points along the way, especially in the East, but also in the Western Conference Finals with Golden State, it was not inevitable really until the end. Something that I want to get into with you here, we'll get into this as regards the finals in a little bit, but something that we're unveiling in the FDH Lounge, we did it first with football and then with hockey, now for basketball, our ultimate quantitative baseline. We've been doing it for years now for fantasy football and fantasy baseball, fantasy hoops, fantasy hockey, etc., all the fantasy sports. The ultimate baseline stat on what a player did last year, quantified in one number. We're now applying it in the FDH Lounge for teams and how they did. So I have averaged together in a blender a bunch of different stats here, and we're going to take a look at where some of the teams in the playoffs placed on this. The first one is a stat that is one half how teams did in our final FDH Lounge power rankings and one half strength of schedule based on who they played in the power rankings. So that ranking, that cumulative ranking, is one of the ones here. That, from there we go to offensive rating, defensive rating, EFG, the TS percentage, assist slash turnover ratio, win shares, more about that in a second, and three-point percentage for teams, because three-point shooting is so very important, of course, in this day and age. Win shares, this is one, Ben, this will make you smile. This is one where I just kind of eyeballed it. I looked at the best player on each team, and I figured how many wins they basically probably meant to the team. So it's an eyeball thing here. The rest of these are exact statistics. That one there, and what I did was, it's 25 points on the score for the Cavs, because LeBron James, I felt, was worth about 25 wins to the Cavs. It skews out a little bit for Golden State just because you got two guys, arguably almost three, who sort of jostle for being the best player. So there's not a single one of them that's the most important necessarily on that. I only put 8 points on them for that, because I figure each of those guys is probably responsible for about 8 wins. So for Golden State, it didn't work out quite like it did for everyone else. Nevertheless, Ben, it won't surprise you to know that with that panoply of statistics, Golden State averaged out first in the league this year.
Right, and that really shouldn't shock anyone, even despite the greatness of Houston this season.
Pretty much.
I think we all have kind of known it's pretty much been Golden State. We all know that. It's been Golden State. We've been talking about this for the last couple of years, and it just seems like, you know, until something changes, it feels like it's Golden State's league to lose at this point. And again, right now, they've taken a lot of heat from other teams, and even though last year was pretty easy for them by default in Durant's first real championship run with them, this year's going to be a little bit more interesting. I think their rotation aren't as good as in previous years, but again, when you have guys like Curry, Thompson, Durant, and Jeff Green, Draymond Green, I'm getting ahead of myself. You have those four guys, I mean, that's pretty much the peak of lineups in the NBA right there, that you just stick whoever you want as your fifth guy. When you have that sort of lineup, and I don't remember what their plus-minus net rating is with those guys on the floor, but I think it's tops in the league or close to tops in the league, so they're really tough to beat, Rick, and that's going to continue to be their story until someone is either able to dethrone them or until they break up at some point.
Yeah, this just in. They're tough to beat. I certainly agree with that. And, yeah, it almost doesn't matter if Rick Morris or Ben Shue is the fifth man. You're still going to beat most teams in the league with that being the case. When we get to talking about the finals, we'll talk about particularly with Iguodala being banged up in the playoffs, that depth has been a little bit more of an issue for them than it has been the last couple of years. But again, when you got four guys like that, you can really kind of withstand a lot when it comes to depth. Before we turn to the finals, I'm going to lay this out here, 1 through 30 in the league, because I think there are some things that kind of enumerate what we saw in the playoffs and some things that maybe wouldn't be as big of a surprise. Quite frankly, if I'd thought of this stat a couple of weeks ago, maybe we could have been ahead of the curve. But here's how it comes out. Unsurprisingly, Golden State is first in the metric, Cleveland 2, Toronto 3, Houston 4, New Orleans 5, Philly 6, Utah 7, think about that, Milwaukee 8, Denver 9, Indiana 10, Boston 11, Minnesota 12, Washington 13, Portland 14, Oklahoma City and Detroit tied for 15th, that's interesting, Miami 17th, Charlotte 18th, San Antonio 19th, the Clippers 20th, Dallas 21, Brooklyn 22, New York 23, the Lakers 24, Atlanta 25, Orlando 26, Chicago and Sacramento tied for 27, Memphis 29, Phoenix 30. So if you look at this again, Ben, Utah and New Orleans, on paper, fairly sizable upsets in the first round. This metric would have told you to expect that. So I find that to be interesting. Were there any things that really surprised you either way as you heard those numbers?
I mean, not overall. I think in terms of the, just to go into the New Orleans-Portland series, I think a lot of people were unsure about how that series outcome would be because of how Portland was playing going into that series. And New Orleans had lost Cousins within the last couple weeks of the season. So when that happened, a lot of people were intrigued to see how good New Orleans was. But, I mean, just based off those numbers alone, Rick, it seems you can tell where the hierarchy is in the league right now. It is surprising to hear Denver that high, but let's be honest, they just barely missed the playoffs. They essentially lost a playing game to get into the playoffs. That's not really super shocking for me.
Exactly. And that's, you know what? And
it's surprising, not shocking.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's put this under the microscope, because, by the way, on the win shares, what I did, that's the only category where I didn't go by rankings, because what it is I add up the rankings in every category, and then for win shares, I subtract a certain number off of that. Like, I subtracted 25 off of the Cavs score because of LeBron. So for Denver, here's how it goes. They're a perfect example of this, because they were pretty consistent across the board in a lot of categories, tied for 7th in our metric of the rankings and strength of schedule, power rankings and strength of schedule, 6th in offensive rating, only 26th in defensive rating, which cost them, 6th in EFG, 7th in TS percentage, tied for 11th in assist to turnover ratio. From there, they were, I subtracted 8 off of them on the win shares for the center there. And subsequently, they were 7th in three-point percentage. So a lot of metrics that were pretty strong across the board, much like the Cavs not doing as well in the defensive rating. Obviously, that was the Cavs' Achilles heel in this one as well. But, yeah, that's one of these things, Ben. If you look at those across the board, you look and you say, gee, it's no wonder that Denver was almost right there in a very crowded Western Conference playoff picture.
Mm-hmm. And they're going to be right there moving forward, too. And it's going to be interesting to see the chart where their growth will be. I know Millsap was probably, his injury was probably one of the big reasons why they didn't make the playoffs. But they're a fun young team. It's going to be very interesting to see how they make that jump or decline in the West.
They really are. They're one of the more interesting teams in the league to look at right now. This metric, as it regards the two teams in the finals, that's the perfect way to sort of segue right there. The only, and I do mean only, category where the Cavs have the upper hand here, although they're fairly close in a lot of them, but the one where they have the upper hand is the one that is one-half power rankings and one-half strength of schedule based on that. Based on the Cavs playing in the Central, based on Golden State playing in the Pacific, the Cavs placed 3rd in that metric, and Golden State was 12th. But from there, offensive rating, Golden State 1, Cleveland 5. Defensive rating, Golden State tied for 8th, Cleveland 29th. I don't know about the validity of that one as regards the Cavs. We'll talk about that in a moment because of the amount of turnover they had this year. EFG, you've got Golden State 1, Cleveland 3. TS percentage, same thing, 1 and 3. Assist to turnover ratio, Golden State 1, Cleveland tied for 8th. And from there, again, I subtracted 8 points off of Golden State for the win shares, 25 off of Cleveland in that one. And 3-point percentage, yet again, Golden State 1, Cleveland was 6 in that. So the total number of points there, again, least points is the best, obviously. Golden State at 17, very low for all those categories there. Cleveland was 2nd, but at 32 points. It was really kind of crowded from there. Toronto, who again, a very good regular season team, and yes, that's the backhanded compliment I intend it to be, they had 33 points, so they were 3rd. Houston had 35 points, so they were 4th. So Cleveland was jammed up tight with Toronto and Houston behind them. There was a gap between Cleveland and Golden State 1 and 2, which again, is pretty much what we would all expect. Again, as I'm running through all those categories, I know that those are no surprise to you as far as how those teams played out in that.
Right. And going into this finals, it is a pretty much, you know, a different year, same story. But it's going to be one of those things that we've always noted about in the league. It's one of those rare narratives that you get to see a matchup for the 4th time in a row, even though both teams are now drastically different than even last year's iteration. It's going to be, I think, a pretty interesting series overall.
It's going to be, and from my perspective as a Cavs fan, the more interesting, the better, because the less interesting it is, the less good it is from my point of view, that's for sure. But as we're looking at this, again, 29th for the Cavs in defensive rating, this is one of these things where LeBron has been saying for quite a while now, this is almost sort of like 5 seasons in one, and again, given that you're looking at stretches that involved whether it be Derrick Rose, Isaiah Thomas, Dwayne Wade, none of the departed who are not as fondly remembered, that are either, again, their factoring into that metric is really not sort of representative of where the team is as a whole. This is one of these things where, again, you and I talked about this off-air right about the time of the trade deadline, the very drastic moves by the Cavs. You and I, again, as hoops historians, struggling to reconcile in our heads a team that is a solid championship contender and has been for the last couple of years making such drastic moves at the deadline. And you and I really couldn't come up with much of a precedent, at least in the modern NBA. And it's one of these things where, again, I've talked about this a lot, that the difference between, again, people love to use shorthand of everyone sucks on the team except for LeBron and Love, and that's not true. Everyone is inconsistent except for them. You're capable of getting very good games, whether it be from George Hill, Kyle Korver, J.R. Smith, although those are increasingly infrequent, etc., etc., etc. They're all inconsistent. And again, what doesn't help matters is not much time to gel. We looked at it like, well, there's going to be the second half of the season, but then Love was out a good chunk of the way. They didn't get a chance to play with the new guys and with him. And this is one of these things, too. Part of what we've seen with the Cavs, instead of the usual 12-2 romp through the East, this year it's 12-8, and basically peeing blood the whole way just to get even that done. Part of that is the consequence of this is a team that's still coming together. This is almost sort of like the December or January of the season, if you want to take into account when these guys got here and how long these guys have been playing together. And it's uncharted territory to see a team like this in the finals.
Right, and everyone has made the jokes, and everyone has said a lot about just the Cavalier roster makeup. And if we're being honest, there have been people that have been on record saying that pretty much it was lucky that Cleveland got the road they got, and that overall the team is going to be an automatic sweep. I don't think you can really call it lucky to get the 4th seed in the East. And then have to play a good young Indiana team, play a one-seeded Toronto team, and then play Boston with home court. I don't think that's really lucky. That's just more, that's the road you take. I think, especially with sports, we talk about luck a lot. And I think there is narratives in games where you can say luck has played a factor. I just don't think you can say luck is in terms of the road. But to be brutally honest, if you kind of looked at how this Cavalier team has worked together, we've been in this super narrative of the super team. Let's be honest, this current Cavs team is a throwback to the old school. You arguably have the top NBA player in the game today. Let him do all the work, and everybody else just has to do what they need to do. And so far, it seems like Cleveland has been able to figure it out. It's going to be interesting to see, because in the Boston series, in both of those final two wins, it was clear the game plan was to muck it up, slow down the tempo, and do their best to try and win. In Golden State, it's going to definitely be more up-tempo. We'll see if Love's going to clear concussion protocol this week. But it's going to, like I said, it's going to be an interesting series. I just think a lot of people have underrated the moving parts, because I think the big assumption has always been you need a lot of help to win in the NBA. And here's a newsflash for everybody. If you have the best player in the league on your team, as long as the rest of the guys are trying to contribute, you're going to be right there every time.
Absolutely. And it's one of these things where, again, if you don't have a big three, it really is kind of a glass half full, glass half empty kind of a thing. The glass half empty is just about everybody aside from the big two is inconsistent to whatever degree. But the glass half full is there's a lot of opportunities to mix and match. If this isn't working, you go to another look. If that look doesn't work, you go to another look. There's a lot of different things you can try with this roster, and Ty Lue, for as much as people give him crap, has been willing to try a lot of different things along the way here. And this is a thing, too. I was on Joe Stazak's show on 97.5 in Philly the other day, previewing Game 7. And again, I was admitting, I am the epitome of, at this point, the grumpy, prematurely old man when it comes to stupid media narratives. The Cavs are the number one topic, not just in the sports world, but the world as a whole for stupid media narratives. And whether it be everybody on this team sucks aside from the big two or anything like that, as I said, people comparing this team to 07. It's LeBron's first team in the 2010s to go to a finals without a big three. It's a big two. Of course it's a cut below the last 7 years, but to compare it to 07, we would have killed for George Hill on that team. I'm not even going to get into Kevin Love. We would have killed for Hill, potentially even Jeff Green, although we had Drew Gooden, so I guess it's sort of like six of one, half dozen of another, but, you know, Kyle Korver. We would have loved to have had Jeff Korver on the 07 Cavs. So this is a thing where it's lazy to say 07 Cavs equals 18 Cavs. That is absolutely insane, much less the fact that, again, LeBron is better today than he was in 07 because he has learned more, he's gotten better, he is so much more advanced on the sports science that basically the age curve, he has sort of frozen it at about age 29, 30, wherever it's frozen, as he continues to get better in the mental game. That's what allows him to play better than he ever has. But as far as the supporting cast that he has versus 07, I find that to be an insultingly stupid comparison that too many of these hoops mavens are throwing around.
I think also to admit, I think a lot of analysts also tend to forget this, is that if you're the best player and you know day in and day out you have to give your best effort every day, it's a lot different. It's a different mindset entirely. To use the analysis, to pull in an NFL analogy, if you know you're the best player on the worst team, you realize that every game you have to play at your best. And in a way that's mentally restrictive because you know you don't have help, but it's also mentally freeing because you aren't having to think, well, I need to make sure I get this guy going, this guy going, this guy going at the end of the day. You realize that it's a simpler mindset, I like to think. If you know you're the man and you have to do it, it's a lot simpler.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a thing where I've had a lot of training for being a fan of a team like this Cavs team just from, again, knowing some of the people I've known in my life. And I will go to, for example, FDH Director of Research Nate Noy, who, again, is on a raw brilliance scale, the smartest person I've ever known as far as that goes. But he's a guy also, too, you know, the arrogance of really smart people. He says a lot of things that he just proclaims as facts. And I sit here and I'm like, how do you know that? That's a question I ask people a lot of times when they pontificate. How do you know that? How does anybody know that? And I've joked with him about being in love with his own certitude. But, you know, as a Cavs fan, that's the thing, too. I was in a little dust-up on Facebook the other day with one of our old Sports Talk Network cronies there, Paul Teeple. He was proclaiming the Cavs to be dead going into Game 7. I said, how do you know that? How do you know? How does any of us know what to expect? LeBron's going to show up tonight, and if one or two of the key contributors show up and have a pulse, they got a good chance to win. Turns out they only needed for that to be one of those guys offensively, Jeff Green. It was funny because the Cavs put up a graphic on social media afterwards with LeBron and his numbers, Jeff Green and his numbers, and then J.R. Smith and 12 points, 4 rebounds. It just should have said J.R. Smith also played, because I don't think what he did was really worth highlighting statistically. But that's what it comes down to in any of these games here. It's just a thing of, again, against Golden State, I think we can be a little bit more sure going in how high of a hill that you're pushing the boulder up. But for some of these series in the Eastern Conference here, to come in with certitude and say, we know what we're going to get from this Cavs team tonight, no, you don't. Because for as much as people make the cliche of LeBron winning by himself, LeBron's never won a game by himself. LeBron wouldn't have won Game 7 by himself. Jeff Green had to be there. And you and I have had this inside joke all year about optimal Jeff Green. Are we going to get that version of him? And you were right in the long term when you sort of cautioned me that it would be like rooting for a unicorn to appear. But I will tell you this, Game 6 and Game 7, it happened. We got optimal Jeff Green out there. And it was fun to watch, Ben, in those games, because it was like in 2015 with Delly, 2016 with Richard Jefferson. It's fun seeing a guy put up games to where you look at it and go, wow, that guy will never have to buy a beer in this town ever again. And it happened with Jeff Green. And again, as much as people have made it about LeBron, and it is, because he has to go out there and be the best player in the game, if he doesn't get at least a second effort from somebody, this team never wins any games.
Right. And I think, as I noted to you prior and cautioned you prior, it's kind of been Jeff Green's M.O. his entire career.
Yes.
And it's also, I mean, that team trade by the beast. A lot of people tend to forget that he did play in Boston, I believe, in the 2012-2013 season. And he was really good. He had a couple big 40-point games for them. And they thought he was going to be one of those guys who was going to be a long-term good player for them to possibly build around. And then he had the open-heart surgery, and that pretty much I wouldn't say derailed his career, but it caused definite pause, and there was definite discussion. He would not play again. But in thinking about it, I did remember I read a piece in SB Nation today where essentially the comparison was made is that LeBron has always, for him, he's always wanted the guy who's kind of like him in a way. And Jeff Green, very strangely, is kind of like LeBron in a way. You know, he's a lanky, he's a big-bodied 6'8", 6'9", 6'10", guy who can get to the basket, plays good defense, and, you know, can make plays when he needs to make plays. The issue is that his career has kind of been a huge ebb and flow, and the major issue for a lot of fans of teams that Jeff Green has been on his entire career was one day you get the Jeff Green who will put down 40 points, the next day you'll get the Jeff Green that scores 6 and has, like, 5 turnovers. So it's the biggest issue of his career, but sometimes, like I said, sometimes stuff just happens in the NBA, and it's funny to say because I remember, too, when he was signed, a lot of people were like, well, that's just that was a running joke, too. Jeff Green got signed by Cleveland. What in the world is he going to do? Funny thing, you know, sometimes, you know, the least logical move is the best, and at the time, Green was one of those guys who was kind of toiling in the, you know, the outskirts of the league, and it's proven that he's a really good player still, and he's been in the league ever since. To quote back to my Seattle ties, he and Durant are the last two Sonics active in the league now, and people tend to forget Green's been in the league for over 10 years now. And at this point, you have to give him credit for staying in the league for this long, because some guys are flash in the pan guys, and he's still playing in the NBA, despite all the issues and the change of his career trajectory.
Exactly. And I understood completely what they were doing last offseason because, again, he's a guy who's got a good amount of upside, especially as cheap as he is. The whole thing of, like, salary to upside is really pretty skewed as far as the ratio goes. And, again, this is a team that's had cap problems the last couple of years just because of all the contracts and everything like that. So I thought it was a perfect way to roll the dice. It paid off when they needed it. We'll see what happens in the finals. And, again, and it sort of reminds me, I think last year we kind of did this with the finals too. We did not spend as much time talking about Golden State just because I think it's the same thing. If Golden State does what Golden State does, you know, there's not too much to talk about there. They got their big four. If Curry, Durant, Thompson, and Green are able to go out there and look like facsimiles of themselves, this will be a relatively short series. There ain't much to say. So it's more so a thing of what can the Cavs do to go to that scenario of making it interesting and or potentially even steal this one. And it's a thing where I'm looking at it like Jeff Green in for Kevin Love. It just shows you how situational basketball can be. Because you would never, in a vacuum, ever say, and Kevin Love is my favorite player, I would never say Cavs better off without Kevin Love. That's a stupid thing to say. But situationally against Boston, as far as the matchups go, and matchups are so key to basketball. The Cavs match up great with Toronto, not so great against Indiana. You saw the difference in those series. Jeff Green with the athleticism, the ability to finish in traffic, his ability to guard people relative to what Love could do. Situationally, it was good to have him in there. It would have been good to have Love available at least to come off the bench. The Cavs, there's no question they would have been better if Love could have been in there. But going heavier away from him in the end was not necessarily a bad thing vis-a-vis the matchups. One of the big questions to me is about the finals, and maybe this is the biggest one, because you're going to get, again, all the media vultures who, again, and I tweeted about this today, just how happy I am, just from a spiteful point of view, that everyone from all the debate shows and Chris Mannix and everyone who's buried the Cavs all year long have to come to Cleveland in June, which is the one thing they didn't want to have to do. So in a spiteful sense, I'm happy. But all the media vultures who are going to be saying, well, the Cavs only won one game last year with Kyrie, they'll get swept without him. I kind of look at it the other way, because last year there was a thing where, and you look at it in game four, and you could kind of see where the Cavs were coming from. I'm not necessarily saying the Cavs were trying to outscore them last year, but when you got your own big three, it's a little bit more plausible you could go one way or you could go the other way. Without Kyrie, at least there's clarity, and that is, you got to go to the sandpaper, and I'm talking the 40 grit stuff from 2015 and Game 7 of 2016, because you are not going to beat Golden State if they resemble themselves. And the one thing I will say is, again, they're a finesse team, they're a rhythm team, and they don't like getting sandpaper shoved on them. They don't like being tugged down into the mud pit. So doing whatever you can do to disrupt their rhythm, cause them to have bad shooting nights, essentially dumb down their game to where it is somewhere how a semblance of what your game is, and you still got to have two or three guys step up that you don't even necessarily know going in who they're going to be. That, to me, is the scenario, Ben Chu. The only scenario whatsoever is you got to pull Golden State down to your level. It's easier said than done, but if we're talking pathways here, and that's what we're talking, I don't see another one.
Right, and I think just overall with Cleveland's game plan going into the series, and I'll touch on Golden State in a little bit as well, but it's very simple. How they were able to win Game 6 and Game 7 of the Boston series was you slow the tempo down, you let LeBron play some ISO basketball, get easy shots, force them to take bad shots, and then try and make sure that you can just muck up the game for as long as humanly possible. One of the issues I've always had with teams that are very high-powered offenses in any sports, the issue that people try to do when they create other teams to try to mimic that team is the narrative that the only way to beat that team is to outscore them. Here's a newsflash for people. You're not outscoring Golden State on most nights.
Right.
You're not. It's just not possible. You're better off trying to do what the Pistons did for the Bad Boys era for so long, which is muck up the game, pause you know, Golden State to take difficult shots, force them to out of their comfort zones, because especially with rhythm teams in any sport, if you're off rhythm, you can catch them once or twice. It's not going to be that big of an issue. The major thing for me with Golden State moving forward is they're clearly the favorites, and they're probably going to make quick work of Cleveland in this series. The big question for them moving forward is going to be, in my personal opinion, you know what you're going to get from Durant, from Curry, and from Thompson. The question is from the rest of that unit, the rest of the team. Is Iguodala going to be healthy? Is Jordan Bell going to be healthy? Are you going to, if Curry's not having a good shooting night, is Nick Young going to be able to put in those extra points? Everything with Golden State in prior years have been, their bench depth is the best. This is arguably the worst bench depth they've had during their last four-year run of going to the NBA Finals. So there are some weaknesses. Houston, and during the series, you know, the Western Conference Finals, show that you can beat Golden State. They're not invincible. But it's going to be very determined on how Cleveland's defensive game plan is going to be. Because if Golden State, if this turns into a long track meet, Golden State's going to make quick work of the series.
Absolutely. And like I said, at least there's clarity relative to last year. I could see going in last year where you could have a decent amount of indecision on the part of the coaching staff about which way do we go with this thing here. And the fact that I think you and I were talking going in about maybe we'll see Derek Williams a little bit, arguably the most athletic guy on the team. He didn't get, I don't believe, any meaningful minutes in the series because the Cavs were not willing to sacrifice offense for defense last year. This year, not that you ever want to sacrifice offense for defense, especially against a team like Golden State, but again, they're a rhythm team. You got to try and pull them down to your level. And I go back, I'm a fond person for sports, cross sports analogies. I look at one of my favorite teams of all time in any sport, the 0-2 Detroit Red Wings, with the 9 Hall of Famers, and everyone looks at that Stanley Cup as being preordained, and I assure you it was not. The first two games against Vancouver, losing them at home because they were able to muck it up. Those Red Wings teams, and you would see it in subsequent years with the early outs in the playoffs, rhythm teams in any sport don't like to be moving around in the mud. And Vancouver almost pulled out Game 3. I always say it's like the Battle of Dunkirk there. Vancouver had them in a 5-on-3 spot where if they'd taken the lead in Game 3, the Red Wings might have got swept. We might never be talking about the 0-2 Red Wings except for them being a historic flop. So Golden State clearly is not staring that kind of a fate in the eye here, although if they lose, it's going to be an embarrassment and an upset in the eyes of history and maybe a substantial one. But it's one of these things where it's indicative on the part of the Cavs, too, how they handle it, how they respond to it. It is not a good look for the Cavs that in the losses to Boston and Indiana that really got away from them, it was reminiscent. I was joking about this, that Indiana with their uniforms, they really were in that blowout game, really reminding me of Golden State. This Cavs team the last couple of years, whether it be predominantly, I would say, against Golden State, but when they've lost in the playoffs, tendency to go on tilt. Run down to the other end of the court, jack up threes, don't set your feet, panic, essentially. The Cavs have gone into panic mode in a couple of their bad losses the last couple of years. And it's a thing where no matter what happens against Golden State, they cannot let that happen again.
Right. And I think one stat that everyone's going to be looking at for this finals will be fast break points.
Yes.
Because during the regular season, in matchups between Cleveland and Golden State, they held a 38-14 number, I believe, or at least for sure I know Golden State was averaging roughly 38 points per game in fast break points. So it's going to be a tempo-based series. If you want the blueprint to how Cleveland wins the series, it's very simple. You win all your home games and you try to steal game one or game two in Golden State. It's very simple. This is not complicated math. If Cleveland wants to win this series, they're going to have to win one early in Golden State and then just serve court. I can't speak again today. Hey, you have to serve court at home.
Yes.
There we go.
Absolutely.
I figured I'd get to it at some point.
Yeah, I knew where you were going with that, and I would agree. I think that's what it comes down to in this series. Now, again, looking at it the last 3 years, every step along the way here when you and I have done this, I wish I was only 1-for-3 on the outcomes, but I'm 3-for-3 on the outcomes because I picked Golden State last year, and I picked them in 2015, and I went with the Cavs in 2016. So, and I think I've been pretty close. I don't remember. I have to go back and look at the tapes. I think I said Golden State in 6 the first year. I think I said Cavs in 7 the second year. And last year, I know I said Golden State in 7, which I was pretty close to. Go back and look at the end of Game 3. If the Cavs win Game 3, I got news for you. They're also winning Game 6, and it goes to Game 7. I don't think they would have won Game 7, but I was very close to being right on that one. So this year, this is ironically a more pessimistic pick for the Cavs than I'm making a year ago. I've never been a homer in my actual picks on what I think is going to happen here. As a fan, I certainly think there's a puncher's chance. I think there is a chance for things to go the way that you're talking about here, steal one at Oracle, defend home court, take the title back. That's not how I see it odds-wise. Odds-wise, percentages, I'm saying Warriors in 5.
And as I said, if I'm going to put this out on record first, if LeBron James with this Cavaliers team beats Golden State, it might be the greatest playoff run we've ever seen for an individual player in the league's history.
Yes.
Period.
Yes.
It might be the greatest of all time right at this moment. But at this point, it's really hard for me to believe the way that Cleveland struggled with teams like
Well, I mean, I'd prefer that to five, I guess. I mean, I'd prefer Cavs in any number of games to that. But, yeah, you know, is there anything to be said for this? I don't know if I'm grasping or I'm reaching, but when you're looking at Indiana, when you're looking at Boston, particularly without their big two, although at this point in time it's hard to say that there's a big anything that doesn't involve Jason Tatum, but the fact that Indiana and Boston, you didn't necessarily know what to expect from them as far as how they were going to go, how the key players around the stars were going to step up. I mean, the Cavs know what to expect from Golden State in their sleep. They've seen it. They've been on the business end of it, quite frankly, far too many times. They're far more familiar with Golden State versus all the things, all the tricks, all the rabbits that Brad Stevens was able to pull out of the hat, and to a certain extent, Nate McMillan as well, who coached an outstanding series in the first round. Is there anything to be said for, at least we know, generally speaking, what to expect, even if we find it on paper to be unstoppable?
I mean, I think overall, I think this seems to be, honestly, Rick, one of the two's where I think we'll see what we expect. As we all know, Steve Kerr is one of the best coaches in the league for Golden State, so we know he's willing to adapt if something doesn't work against Cleveland. The question, again, is going to come down to this. How far can the Cavaliers be carried by LeBron at this point? Because at this rate, to look at just the baseline for this team, arguably during this playoff run, LeBron has had to deal with one of his best rebounders being in and out of the lineup. Kyle Korver's been good, not great. He's 37. He's getting up there. He's been a veteran in the league for so long. Arguably his second best player is Kevin Love, who has dealt with injuries and has had bad games during the playoffs. And then pretty much the only thing consistent about the Cavaliers in the last couple of games was Jeff Green, who is arguably the most consistent inconsistent players in NBA history. So, let's be honest, it's going to come down to LeBron. And if LeBron can hold on, there's a legitimate opportunity that he can win this series by himself. The question's always going to come down to, and I think this is a fair assessment of Golden State. If Golden State's firing on all cylinders and they're playing their best game, I'm not going to lie, the series is over.
Sure.
Not even going to question that, because Golden State is what they are. They're a high-powered offense team, no lead is safe, and at some point, you have to cause them peril for the series. And at this point, they're battle-tested, and they're really getting close to the talk of the dynastic era. If it wasn't for, you know, 3-1, 73 wins, unanimous MVP, we could be talking about the first NBA team since the Celtics of the early 50s and 60s to be four-peating in the NBA.
That's true. Yeah, that's true. And fortunately, I have great fond memories of 2016 and the finals that kept it from happening. But I will say that all that is true. And look, if Golden State is playing in their comfort zone most of the time, this is a sweep. We're not even talking about anything. It's all pretty academic. The more they get to resemble the team that they are, if we can put this in a nutshell, the quicker and more decisive it will be in their favor. There's no question about that. When you look at it, too, last thing I'll leave you with is something that you and I have been saying for a while now, and it's not a great thing to say about a team in this position, with all due respect to the guy we're going to talk about, but as goes George Hill, so go the Cavs. And for whatever reason, he was an attacking mofo for the games in Cleveland in the Eastern Conference Finals. Really not the case in Boston. I really thought Game 7 he'd come out attacking. He didn't. There's no scenario for the Cavs winning this thing where he's not out there working hard, trying to take it to the hole, but also hitting some threes and making the Splash Brothers work on defending him. There's no scenario for the Cavs winning this series where George Hill doesn't step up and be the best version of himself, in addition to probably a couple other guys being the best version of themselves. But would you agree with me that George Hill is almost disproportionately key for the Cavs?
I think he's important. I don't know necessarily if he has to be one of the best players on the floor, but he does have to set the tempo for that offense.
Yes.
Because at times, if it goes very heavy LeBron, he'll have to be able to make shots.
Yep.
And he'll have to orchestrate the offense at times. And to give this Cavaliers team bizarre credit, in Game 6 and Game 7, the games were managed very well.
They were very well,
good in terms of clock management and offensive management, defensive management. Very good job across the board, including Ty Lue. But the issue I think that they're going to have to deal with is when you're at Oracle and you get down by 20-plus, we've already seen the Cleveland issues in their series against Boston. If you go down big, most of the time LeBron's not going to have enough energy to bring them back.
Right.
At this point in his career. But it seems to me that I don't think this is a stone-cold lock everyone's saying, because pretty much I think almost every basketball analyst is giving this a 4 or 5 game series. I think the series is going to go 6 only because I think LeBron has enough in him to at least pull out 2 home wins, at least. Because I don't think Golden State's as good as everyone thinks they are. They've run into a scenario where they played the number one team in the West who lost Chris Paul for 2 games, but let's be honest, they kind of deflated at the end. And again, it's sad for them. This has been their MO for the last 2 seasons.
That's right. That has absolutely been the case. And again, George Hill, the other thing about him being very active, too, is particularly the more he's doing the ball handling, the more he can kind of help keep down the usage rate on LeBron, which is going to help a lot because his moments of rest will be few and far between, and that just makes it tougher the further along you go. So there you go. You have the predictions between me and you for this, and again, I think you and I have been in accord on our predictions the last couple of years. We have been right. I will be rooting for us not to go to 4-0 on our predictions during this Cavs-Warriors series here. It will be very interesting to watch. And again, much to the chagrin of the national media and all the pundits and all of them, they got to come to C-Town in June, which is, I know, what they hate the most. So again, we'll be seeing it all play out through the NBA Finals here. Ben Chu, of course, a pleasure as always, my man. Thank you for being here for your peerless hoops analysis, my man.
I appreciate it, Rick. Hopefully we'll have a good finals this year.
I certainly hope so, and I hope it goes the way that it doesn't look like it's going to go, but we'll see how that all plays out. Thank you again, Ben. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in for FDH Lounge, mini episode number 992.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, All Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Awkwafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.